Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Mr. Dobson. Good morning. Morning to you. Appreciated the message that Mr. Jackson gave. That was that could have been the sermon today, and that would have been fantastic. It was really, really a good message. I think especially appropriate for these days that we're going through, these days of unleavened bread. Am I on? Make sure I'm on. Right. Okay. You know, obviously, we're within the days of unleavened bread. They're coming to a close very shortly here in the next couple of days. I hope you don't have cheeseburgers on the brain. And if you didn't, I hope I didn't just put them there. And now if you're thinking about them, just destroy them with fire and they'll be gone. You can think about something else. But we want to think about the meaning of these days, what this has to do with us, what this has to do with our lives, and how we play a part in it. But as I said, the last day of unleavened bread is coming up here in just a couple days, and I think it's a very significant event for us to consider, to look at, to take a view of what has happened on that day. In fact, the paradigm against which all of God's redemptive and saving work was measured occurred on the last day of unleavened bread. Joshua pointed to it. The prophets of old did as well. And the New Testament writers pointed to this last day that we come up on also. And all of them consistently point to the event on that last day as the example of God's deliverance for us. By Jewish tradition, the crossing of the Red Sea occurred on the last day of unleavened bread. Now, before we get to that, I want to go back and read a little about Israel and what they were up against when they fled Egypt. You'll remember that the Israelites had left the city of Ramses at the night to be much observed, which we celebrated. And that was the evening of the beginning of the 15th of the first month. And they had traveled to Ramses from Goshen to depart Egypt, to leave that land. And the Pharaoh, upon the death of the firstborn, remember, had sent a message to Moses and to Aaron by night. And he said, leave, get out. Depart from me. And we don't know that Pharaoh saw him. He probably didn't see Pharaoh, not like depicted in the movie, because he said earlier, he said, I will see your face no more. So he said to leave Egypt. And so by night, Moses and Aaron gathered everyone together, some 3 million or so Israelites, and they were on their way, and they left Ramses in chapter 12, we see. They left Ramses. And they traveled to a place called Sukkot to camp. And then from there, they traveled to Etham on the edge of the wilderness. And at this point, they were just about gone. They were almost ready to leave Egyptian soil. They were ready to put sin behind them. But God then told Moses to do a curious thing. He told him to turn south, apparently away from the land that they were promised, away from the freedom that they had sought, and toward the clutch of the Egyptians. You see, God was leading them to a dead end. I'd like you to turn to Exodus chapter 14 and look at this story. Exodus chapter 14. And I want to start reading here in Exodus chapter 14. And verse 1. And it starts out and it says, and now the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn and camp before Pi-hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, and opposite Baal-zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. And so Israel is to camp here at Pi-hahiroth, which was an apparent dead end. This was a dead end for them. The sea was there before them, and they had the mountains on either side of them. And unbeknownst to them at the time, an enemy was soon going to be at their back, was soon going to come up behind them, and they were trapped. They were trapped, and their only way out was up. They had no other way out. But this was where their salvation was to come. Their salvation was to come from above. I have several principles here for you today. I think I have four that we can glean from this story. And principle number one is this. God will sometimes position us in a way that our deliverance from sin is for His glory and for His honor. God will sometimes position us in such a way that our deliverance from sin is for his glory and for his honor. Well, isn't it always for his glory and his honor? But sometimes he puts us in a position so that he can make his glory known to all mankind. God had planned for this to happen. He had planned for them to be there. You know, we shouldn't think that God didn't know what was going to happen. You know, in the story of the Ten Commandments, the movie, Pharaoh says, yes, God is a poor general. You know, he traps them. He doesn't know what he's doing. No, God saw this like a chess match. He saw this years in advance. He knew what was happening. God sometimes raises difficulties in our way in the salvation of his people so that he has the glory in subduing them. And that is subduing the difficulties to help the people overcome the trial. Now, it may be that we go through trials, and we all do, where we feel boxed in, we feel enclosed, we feel like there's mountains on each side of us, and we don't feel like there's a way out. But what's happened is God has simply orchestrated the situation so that our deliverance is simply for his glory. It's for his honor, so that others can see what he does. It's for his purpose. And really, brethren, we're simply just an instrument in his hands. We're simply an instrument in his orchestra that he plays for his will to be accomplished. I want you to turn to John chapter 9, the book of John. And in this gospel, according to John, we see the story of a man who was given a very special condition in life in John chapter 9. He was given a very special condition. And we see a man who had been blind from birth. He'd been blind from birth. In John chapter 9 and verse 1, we read, "And as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from his birth. And his disciples had asked him, saying, 'Master, who did sin, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?' And Jesus answered, he said, 'Neither has this man sinned nor his parents, but that the works of God should be made manifest in him.'" What an orchestration of events that must have occurred here. To think that God had orchestrated all of this, his whole life, so that this event would come about. Now, we don't know how old this man was. We can take some guesses. We can speculate about this. I think he was apparently old enough to be out on the streets begging for his sustenance. His parents says that he was of age. Later we see that he was of age. Now, some of the commentaries disagree on this. Many of them, you will see, says that he was at least 13, because I guess that's when the Jews go through this this transition point where they reach puberty. And so some of them will put him at 13 or a little bit older. But I find it curious that they call him a man. I find it curious that, you know, even in Israel, they didn't count them part of the armies or part of the census until they were, I think it was 20, if I remember that right, 20. So I believe when you look at the story and the way this man reasoned with the Pharisees there, that he was older. In fact, he could have been 20 to 30. Maybe he was 30. We see 30 as a definite age of maturity in the Jewish culture. So he was definitely, I think, an older man, not a boy. And he had lived his whole life up to that point without sight. He had not seen anything. I think one of the things we don't consider in this story is the emotions that must have been running through the mind of his parents when this young boy was born. He was born blind, and his parents had given birth to this blind boy. And what did they think when they brought this child blind into a world that is full of vivid colors? It is full of hues and different gradients. The beauty that we see in nature around us, where he was brought into a world that has such shapes and sizes to it and shadows. And he was brought into a world that has so much motion and movement and so many things that he could not see and never would have an opportunity to see. How his parents must have thought about this. What kind of life was he going to grow up to have? How you think about this child would never see his parents' faces, is neither one of them. They would never get to see the smiles on their parents' face. He would never get to see the grins or the laughter or the giggles of his siblings. I'm sure he had brothers and sisters. Most of them were not singlets at that time. And this boy was not going to be able to run around and play with the other boys in that culture either. He wouldn't be able to do that because he was blind. It's something he wouldn't be able to do. And how much sadness his parents must have felt for him, how much remorse they must have had, even wondering, possibly to themselves, if there was something that they did wrong to sin against God to bring this thing about, this condition on him. This man, this boy, was born blind in a world that was built for sight. This world was built for seeing. And for all the time of his childhood, he was left in darkness. He could see nothing. And while the other boys went on to learn a trade, his parents were left to care for him. And when other boys grew up and they had families and they took care of their families, he was left on the side of the road begging for his dinner, for someone to support him. These are the things I think we don't think about. But God orchestrated this event. God orchestrated all this. He knew all the suffering that was going to go on in this man's life, in the life of his parents. But God orchestrated the events of his life to the point that one day, God himself was going to come up and going to touch this man and was going to release him from the bondage that he was in, from the captivity that he was held in his blindness. For what? Well, what does it say? It says to show the works of God in him. To show the works of God in him. For some 20 to 30 years, he was waiting for freedom to come. He surely must have thought about this deep in his heart. He must have had some desire that burned within him that maybe he would regain his sight back. Maybe one day. I mean, surely he knew about the Messiah, the stories of the Messiah in the Old Testament, the prophets had told, that he would come and open the eyes of the blind. Maybe he had some flicker in his heart that this was going to happen. And maybe it was buried. It had been so long. He thought, well, maybe it won't happen for me in this life. But unknown to him, God had a plan for this man. And his story was going to be canonized so that we all read it today. With his healing, God was showing that we are the instruments of his mighty orchestra and that his will is to be accomplished in a way that he chooses at his time in his perfect and divine plan. You know, this was what was happening in Egypt. This was happening in Egypt. I want you to look at Exodus chapter 14 again as we'll go on, and we'll use Exodus 14 as our main theme as we go through and break off at time from times. But Exodus chapter 14, we see in verse 3, the Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. And then I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over all his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. All of these things, brethren, written down, not just for that time. The blind man glory, the blind man's healing was not for the glory of God to be revealed just to those people there. It was for the whole world. It was for everyone that would read the story, that we would have the testimony written down for us to know, as well as we see here in the story of the Exodus. To illustrate this point further, I'm going to read from Romans chapter 9. You don't need to turn there. I'm going to read from the Living Translation, and Paul quotes from Exodus 9:16 is what he's doing. He says, Paul writes, as he's quoting, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, was an example of this fact. For God told him that he had given him the kingdom of Egypt for the very purpose of displaying, for the very purpose of displaying the awesome power of God against him, so that all the world would hear about God's glorious name. So the whole world would know. And of course, at that time, many nations around did hear about this. The world does know about this today. But the nations around did hear about it. The Philistines, the Amorites, they all heard about what had gone on, what was happening. and the others in the land of Canaan heard of the miracle that had occurred, this crossing of the Red Sea, and how God fought for the for Israel against the armies of Egypt. And they were afraid. They were afraid of the God that fought for Israel. They were afraid of him. And brethren, the first thing that we have to realize is that first, everything points to God. Doesn't everything does? And sometimes things aren't about us. They're not about us. We're just part of his plan, part of making his plan come together and making it work. We're simply the clay of the maker that he is molding, and he is shaping us to make his unique sculpture. Now, Pharaoh was told about the location of the Israelites and how they were trapped. And then, as God had said, he regretted letting Israel go. And he got together his choice chariots and his top fighting force. Josephus tells us that besides them, Pharaoh had taken 50,000 horsemen and 200,000 foot soldiers, if we can trust the words of Josephus. Now, imagine if you could that size of an army marching after you if you were put yourself in the camp of Israel and you see the armies of Pharaoh coming after you. You're not prepared for battle. This is not what you are. You're not a war like people. You don't have armies. What would you think? I mean, how would you react if you were there? Well, let's see how Israel reacted in Exodus 14 and verse 9. It says, so the Egyptians pursued them, and all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and overtook them, camping by the sea beside Pihahiroth before Baal-Zephon. And when Pharaoh drew near, the children of Israel lifted their eyes. So I want you to note that and keep that in your head. They lifted their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them. And so they were very afraid, and the children of Israel cried out to the Lord. Principle number two. Principle number two is fear is a byproduct of faithlessness. Fear is a byproduct of faithlessness. Notice that the children of Israel had lifted their eyes and they were afraid. I'd like you to turn to Matthew chapter 14. Matthew chapter 14. You know, living in a world of sight is sometimes difficult because of the things that our eyes do see. They can deceive us. They can tell us that what is in front of us will overtake us. What's behind us is going to grab us and steal us away. That there's no way out. Sometimes our eyes will tell us that. Our eyes tell us that we function within the universe by ourselves alone without the divine hand to catch us. We don't see the invisible. We don't see that. We don't see the divine hand there that is there to strengthen us, that's there to protect us when we walk simply by sight. Matthew chapter 14, we see this famous episode when Jesus came walking on water to his disciples, and Peter had come out to the water also. And remember that Jesus had called him to come out onto the water with him. And then Peter was walking on water. Now we hear this story so many times we think, yeah, Peter walked on water, no big deal. Well, this is quite something that Peter walked on water. Now, that is an incredible, incredible story. The defiance of physics that had to occur to be able for this to happen. Now, normally the reason that, for instance, we can stand on this floor or we can sit in the chairs or the chairs sit on the floor without them going through the floor, right, without me just falling right through it, is because the electrostatic forces of the chair or of the floor, right, are stronger than the forces of gravity. So one force is stronger than the other, and it doesn't overcome it. Now, with water, we have a hydrogen bond, which is a strong bond in chemistry, but it's not very strong electrostatically when you compare it to the forces of gravity. And so when you walk on water, you fall right through it because gravity is stronger. Now, I don't know how this event played out. I don't know if God manipulated the forces to allow this. I suppose he did, whether he made one stronger and one weaker. It really doesn't matter, does it? It doesn't really matter. What matters is why Peter began to sink. Why did he begin to sink? Look at verse 30. It says, but when he saw the wind boisterous. So when he saw it, he looked around. He took his eyes off of the captain of his salvation. And he saw the wind that was around him and the sea and the boisterous waves that were all around him. And he was afraid. And he began to sink and he cried, Lord, save me. And immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and caught him and said to him, oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt? Faithlessness leading to fear. Fear is our enemy. Fear is our enemy, brethren. And faithlessness is believing that God is not sovereign in our life. Believing that he doesn't have total control over the events that take place in our life. And when we take our eyes off the captain of our salvation, who is left to save us? Who is left? There is no one. We have ourselves. Are we the ones that we've been waiting for? No, we don't save ourselves. But in the face of adversity with fear, we have this tendency to walk by sight and not by faith. There is much more in this life, brethren, to be joyful over than there is to be afraid of. Fear can compound on itself and it can grow exponentially if we let it. If we let fear take a hold of us, it will just roll and spin and continue to grow. And it will take us over and it consumes our every thought on a daily basis. Fear can do that. And we can make mountains out of molehills with fear. It's not just for misunderstandings. These mountains can come. We could set up many barriers to listen to and to believe what God tells us in the pages of his Bible. And that would be an easy way to talk ourselves right into a life of fatalism. Believing that this is the way that I've been given and I'll just have to suffer through it. If God put me in this cast of life, then I will just live it and suffer. You know what the Hindus believe or the Buddhists. What a dark world that is to live in. I think even the rational minds don't like to think about that. But look back at, you know, what Israel went through, what they had just gone through in leaving Egypt. And all the miracles that had occurred, you know, despite the 10 miraculous plagues that had occurred in Egypt just days earlier, ending with the death of the firstborn of Egypt. Israel looked with their eyes and they took their eyes off their leader. They took their eyes off their leader, Moses, who was a type of Christ. He was set up as a type of Christ. He was a type of God to the elders. He was a type of God to Aaron and to Pharaoh, it even says, you will be a God to him. And when they took their eyes off of him, they feared. And they feared what man could do instead of fearing what God could do because of their lack of faith. And they didn't believe that God could save them or maybe even would save them from what was going to happen. Now, let me just say that when we look at the story that's going on here, this is a physical example that sets us for a spiritual purpose. So God could allow them to be killed. But the point here is that this is a spiritual example of being overtaken in a spiritual death. So even though they were looking to God to be saved physically, our example is that we look to God to be saved spiritually. Because there are many examples that we see in the Bible, and we could go to, and I don't have time, but we could go to Revelation chapter 2, and we could look at what God told the church at Smyrna and how the tribulation that they would undergo under the rule of Diocletian for those 10 years, you would be persecuted unto death. So God doesn't necessarily spare our lives, but he spares us from sin. And that's the point that he's trying to make here. You know, if you read the Drudge Report, just about any day of the week, it seems like the sky is falling. The world's coming to an end. It can't go on any longer. If you look at Zero Hedge, I mean, just about every hour they've got something new posted on there, and you think the economy is just going to be obliterated in a matter of moments. It's just the stories that are on there. An article is posted, the collapse of the world is coming and it's at hand. And that may be, brethren, that may be. But it continues to tick on for God's purpose. But there's nothing we can do about it. We read these stories. What can we do about it? There's nothing that we can do about it. Now, I'm not saying that doesn't mean we have to or we shouldn't watch world events. We have to. We have to be prudent. We have to plan for things. I mean, those things we have to do. But to sit there and wring our hands over, oh no, this story in the Drudge Report. Oh no, this thing, you know, everything could come crashing down at any moment. Well, that may be, but we are still within the hands of God. And He still plans, has us at the center of His plan. Now, since everyone I'm speaking to here is human, we all have similar human emotions. We're all similar in this way. And I know that you've been there before. I've been there before, where we have these worries and we have these doubts about something that seems so important to us. And it's something that we're going through and we don't know how we're going to get through it. We don't know how it's possible this is going to come out with us on the other side intact. Now, when you're, let's say, a youth and you have to go to, let's say, the prom and you have the biggest pimple in the world on your nose, it's the end of the world. Now, as you get older, it's not as important. You say you got a couple pimples, no big deal. But things will escalate in life. There are things that are more important. There are things that affect us more. Speaking personally, there was a time 2 years ago where I thought maybe I was going to have to shutter up this business. I was having problems severely with insurance, and actually I still am. But you think about all the things that come with that, you know, and I worry about the ramifications of closing up the business. Where do I live? Do I have to go bankrupt? Am I going to start over? Where am I going to get the money to start over a business again? You know, I got my kids. I got to take care of them. I've got things, bills to pay. I've got debts to pay. If I have to move, where do I move? How do I feed my family? All of these things, you know what I'm talking about. We've all gone through something similar to that. You know, in many ways, I don't understand why this is still open. But it is. I'm still here, and God has watched out and taken care of it. Now, there's a running joke among business owners. I don't know if you know this, but you talk to a business owner and you say, well, how was your last quarter? And they say, last quarter was okay. It was actually okay, but I don't know what's going to happen the next quarter. And the next quarter, you see him and you say, how was last quarter? And you say, yeah, it wasn't too bad, but I don't know what's going to happen next quarter. And the next quarter you see, well, how is, and it's the same way every quarter. Last quarter was pretty good. I don't know what's going to come the next quarter. It's, you know, it's a wash, rinse, and repeat. Wash, rinse, and repeat. It's the same thing over. And that's sort of the joke about businesses. You know, when you're given a child with a birth defect, you don't know, you don't know what's going to happen. It's very easy to live your life in fear. It's very easy to do that. Many have gone through this. I'm finding this out firsthand, that you can live your life in fear every single day if you want to, if you allow it to happen. Faith was given her name for a very special reason. Not only by faith, we believe that God would play a special part in her life, that He would heal her. Maybe not now, but one day that will happen. But it is a reminder also that we walk daily by faith. Right? That we walk daily by faith, and that God helps us, as it says, from faith to faith. So you move from one faith to the next. That's how we move through life. We kind of make it through from one faith to the next. Not letting go, not believing that God doesn't understand what is going on. We can't lift our eyes like the children of Israel and look at what we see going on around us. We can't live our lives in fear of what may come. We can't live our lives in fear of the unknown. At times, brethren, there are times when we see mountains on our sides. We see them blocking us in. We see that there's no way out. There's something before us. There's something on the side. It's too high to get over. And we feel that there is somebody evil behind us. We feel something breathing down our neck that seems to be suffocating us. But we can't blame God for these things. We can't blame God for the trials that we go through or the sufferings or the problems. Look at the man that was blind from birth again. You think about this man that was healed by Jesus. Why did he say he was born blind? So that the works of God may be made manifest in him. What did this man say to Jesus after he was healed? Did he say, go up to Jesus and say, hey, thanks for giving me 30 years of suffering. Thanks for taking my eyesight away and me missing all of my childhood. Thanks a lot. You left me alone to suffer in my darkness. You know, if you'd left me alone in the first place, I wouldn't have been blind. Did he say anything like that? Nothing. He didn't say he was the reason he was blind. No, we see that he came to an understanding of who God was. We see that he came to an understanding that he was the Son of God. We see the progression that takes place in that section. When something didn't go Israel's way, they complained and they whined and they blamed Moses, which means they were blaming God. It's no different than Israel rejecting the prophet Samuel. They rejected God when they did that. Oh, brethren, we cannot let this happen to us. There is much to be afraid of if we allow ourselves. And this festering can only take us away from the love that exists within the bosom of God. He is our ultimate place of comfort and security. And if we don't find comfort in the bosom of God, where do we find it? Where do we find it? We find it in the comfort of the enemy. Principle number three is this. Principle number three is faithless people return to the bosom of sin. Faithless people return to the bosom of sin. Notice again in Exodus chapter 14 and verse 11. Then they said to Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? You see, they wanted to go back to Egypt. They wanted to go back to slavery because they were scared and they lacked the faith that was required to save them. And they were more fearful of Satan and his minions, the Pharaoh and his armies, than they were of God. Brethren, when we think about it and we make this dash across the wilderness that Israel made, and we make it ourselves, to leave sin behind, we have to be careful to not become fearful of what we foresee or what we see as the apparent bad consequences of leaving sin. And sometimes it seems like there are bad consequences of leaving sin behind. Just as Israel had dashed across the desert to leave sin, we cross this barrenness that exists around sin because sin engulfs its surroundings, doesn't it? It gives us this picture of the life in Egypt around the Nile as this center of sin. That's the center of sin in Egypt around the Nile. It flourished with sin. And then around it was the desert. And sin engulfs that whole desert area. And when you move to the desert, you see what you feel are the consequences of reaching sin, because now you're in a barren place. You feel, I got to get back. I got to get back to the place that I was comfortable at. And so sin's effects have the intent that it wants to keep us at its center where it seems to be comfortable. It seems that way. I mean, who wants to go and dwell in the desert when you have the comforts of Egypt? Why would you want to do that? Well, when we leave sin, sometimes it takes a period to escape. Not only do we have to leave the comfort that it seems that sin provides, but we have to get through the wilderness at the edge of sin where we begin to see the consequences of leaving sin. Now, consequences are simply the result of an action, either good or bad. It doesn't matter. But as Israel looked at what they saw as the ill consequences of leaving sin, they feared. I mean, when they saw Satan and his demons, that is Pharaoh and his armies, coming after them, when they were fleeing subjugation, they thought they were going to die as a result of leaving sin. They thought that was going to be the result. Think of this spiritually, not physically. Well, in like manner, as we abandon sin, Satan and his armies breathe down our neck. They want us back. They don't want us to get away. Remember when Moses had approached Pharaoh early on in the story, and Mr. Jackson had referred to this. In Exodus chapter 8 and verse 28, it says, Pharaoh said, I will let you go, that you may sacrifice to the Lord your God in the wilderness. Only don't go that far away. Just go a little ways. And then, and come back. Just go a little way. And then in chapter 10, he again says, Pharaoh says, well, okay, just the men can go. Just the men can go, but the women, the children, and all the flocks, they're going to stay. They can't go. And then down in verse 24, again, what does he say? He says, Pharaoh called and said to Moses, and he said, okay, go serve the Lord, only let your flocks, okay, just let your flocks and herd be stay. You can even take your little ones with you, that's okay. But just leave your flocks here. See, Satan wants to keep us. He wants to keep something that is valuable to us. He's okay with his captives wandering to the desert now and again to see the barrenness. He's okay with that, but he wants something valuable, something that he can keep hold of that can bring us back, that can bring us back into the bosom of sin. Satan wants us to console ourselves in his bosom, and yet it's a false consolation. In 2 Corinthians chapter 10, you can go ahead and turn over there, in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we'll come back to Exodus. Paul writes something about the battle that we go through on a regular basis. Of course, we know we don't battle against flesh and blood, but against spiritual forces and wickedness in high places. But he says in 2 Corinthians chapter 10, and look at verse 3, it says, For though we walk in the flesh, we do not war after the flesh. So our battle isn't against the flesh. For the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty through God to the pulling down of strongholds, casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself above the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. You know, these strongholds are obstacles that in many cases have been set up in our mind, and they are tied back to Egypt. They're tied back to the sinful nature. They're tied back to bondage. They recall Egypt. They recall that in our mind. They bring us back to the metropolis of sin so that we can sit and bathe in the Nile once again. Oh, Pharaoh said, sure, go and worship, but then come back. Go and worship, but, then come back. Well, Moses knew they couldn't do that. They couldn't do that. They couldn't hang around there. They had to be completely free and away from Egypt. It was just simply too easy to worship and then come back. It was just too simple to do that. You know, brethren, oftentimes when we feel that we're at the strongest spiritually, we're really at our weakest. Sometimes when we feel we're at the strongest spiritually, we're really at our weakness. Now, what do I mean by that? I mean to say that spiritual failures come more often in life when we feel good about ourselves spiritually. Success has a way of deceiving us and lulling us to let our guard down. Success, brethren, has destroyed more lives than failure ever has. You know this intuitively. Generally, as a general way of life, when you think about things, maybe you've changed a diet. Maybe you want to change the way your eating habits are, or something like this. And you think, well, I've done so good at eating for the last few weeks. I'll just take a couple days off. I'm okay. I'm doing really well. And before you know it, man, and you're eating all the candies and good stuff that you really liked to eat before. It's like, oh, this is so good. And then it throws you back to where you were. Everybody's gone through this, I'm sure. That's what I'm talking about. There are times, I'm sure, where we felt we're on top of the world. We've got our Bible study down. We've got our prayer habits down. We've been fasting regularly. We've done the things that we really feel good about where our spiritual life is. And then we think, well, I'm doing really good. Maybe I can't think of an example right now, but maybe it's you decide you're going to do a movie marathon one night because I'm going to reward myself for the good progress that I've made. Think of something. And what happens? You stay up so late at night that you get up late the next morning, and then you don't have time for prayer and you don't have time to study. And then the day gets harried. And then by the time you get to the end, there's other things you've forgotten you got to do because you kind of put things off, and then you go to bed and you didn't pray, and then it spirals, and then something happens. That's what I'm talking about. The Bible actually shows many examples of spiritual lapses when we're on top of the world spiritually. In fact, you can hold your spot here because we're going to come back to 2 Corinthians. So hold your spot in Exodus 14 and 2 Corinthians 10. I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 10. 1 Corinthians chapter 10, because Paul specifically addresses what I'm talking about here in terms of the Israelites. And he uses what we're talking about as an example of what I'm saying here. 1 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 6, he says, "Now these things, these Old Testament things, were our examples to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. Neither be you idolaters as some of them were, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit fornication as some of them committed and fell in one day 23,000. Neither let us tempt Christ as some of them also tempted and were destroyed of serpents. Neither murmur you as some of them also murmured and were destroyed of the destroyer." Now all of these things happened to them for examples, and they are written for our admonition upon whom the ends of the world are come. He's writing to us. He's writing to the church. Verse 12. "Therefore, brethren, let him that thinks he stands take heed, lest he fall." What a spiritual high this must have been. What a high this must have been after the armies were destroyed. But how quickly did they fall? How high it was to leave Egypt. They left with a high hand. And how quickly they went down. Just a few days later. And then back in 2 Corinthians, again, chapter 10 and verse 6. As we go on, it reads, or Paul writes, "And having in a readiness to revenge all disobedience when your obedience is fulfilled." What does he mean to say here? What's he saying? He means to say that when we are at a high spiritually, what do? We cast down the strongholds to get there. We have brought those evil and deceptive and adulterous thoughts into captivity of Christ. We've done those things that we should do. We've sacrificed to the Lord. And our obedience has been fulfilled. Then don't take time off to celebrate that. Don't go back to Egypt. What does it say? Be ready now to revenge all disobedience. Be ready to revenge all disobedience. Remain faithful. Remain faithful in the bosom where true comfort exists for eternity and not for a season, which leads to principle number four. Principle number four is sin is attractive and comfortable in the short term. Sin is attractive and comfortable in the short term. Eventually, it doesn't become that way, and I'll explain that in a minute. This is really a point that I think we've already touched on a little bit, but I'll just spend a little bit more time that I have. Exodus chapter 14 and verse 12. It goes on to say in this section, "Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, 'Let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians, for it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness'?" You know, lots of times when God calls us and we are confronted with difficulties and problems, we may begin to think the same thing, because the world is nice and it's comfortable and it's warm and everything is available to us. And sometimes we don't think or even understand or forget that when God begins to work in us and continues to work with us, that he will put us through fiery trials to test our character. How would we like to leave today and be thrust into a wilderness somewhere, and we can't take our phones with us, and we can't take all of our connections that we have? It's a withdrawal. I mean, studies have shown that you're not on the internet for a while. You go through withdrawal patterns. You don't have your phone with you. You go through withdrawal. It's some sort of addiction it's a pattern that's developed. God has promised here to deliver his people, and he planned to redeem them from the clutches of sinful Egypt, from the bondage that had oppressed them for so many years. And once faced with a trial, they cried and they said that bondage was better than freedom, and that they would rather be slaves than to die free. Not that they were going to die. Right? They weren't going to die. That wasn't the point. God is setting this up as an understanding that he will not allow us to die spiritually. But they were on the edge of freedom, and yet they were the proverbial dog that returns to its vomit and the sow that returns to her wallowing in the mire. You see, sin was attractive. It was comfortable for them. And it was difficult to escape. This is very important for us today, because when we get sucked into a sin, initially it's pleasurable. Else, why would we do it? There's something about it that looks attractive. The fruit to Eve looked good for food, even though it wasn't. And then we, like the Israelites, make our mad dash across the desert to get to the edge as we're trying to escape that particular sin. And oftentimes we hit that wall. We get trapped by the sea, and we get trapped with the mountains. And it just seems so easy to go back, and pretty nice to go back to Egypt. And the sin looks good once again, until we go back and we realize again that bondage to sin, to that harsh taskmaster, is not it's not a good place to be. And so we have to run across the desert, and it happens many times over and over till we get to the point where we don't fear the consequences of leaving sin any longer. And that is to say that we don't fear, we don't fear the consequences. What's going to happen to us from leaving that particular problem? When we lose that fear, and obviously Christ in us helps us do that, that's the point at which the faith of Christ can take over our lives, and we don't return to the bosom of sin because, well, there's a couple of reasons, I believe. Number one is there's a way out. God provides a way of escape. So we don't see that as an opportunity to go back. But at that point, Christ in us, we have the mind of Christ, and sin is not attractive. Sin does not become attractive anymore. And we are delivered by God in us. Notice verse 13, Exodus 14. And Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid. Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you see today, you shall see again no more forever. The Lord will fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." And the Lord said to Moses, "Tell the children of Israel to go forward." Tell the children of Israel to go forward. And brethren, that's what I see as the theme, really, of the end of the feast and of the last great day. The last day of unleavened bread, even, is to go forward. That's what we are to do, is to go forward. God had promised to deliver, and now he was going to deliver in a big way. A spectacular way. He was going to strike at the heart of the evil one. And verse 21, "And then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into the dry land, and the waters were divided. And so the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground. And the waters were a wall to them on the right and on to the left." Wow. What an amazing act that must have been, to think about yourself being put into that situation and seeing the massive walls of water on either side of you as you're walking down through the Red Sea. I always thought when I was a kid that it would be really cool to be Moses and hold up that staff and make that water part. I think sometimes as we get older, we lose our imagination. I used to fly around the living room with a cape tied to my back and pretending I was Superman. Now my kids do it, except for now they're Batman. I tell them Batman can't fly. He can float. And if I did do it, I wouldn't tell you I was still. As we draw to a close this morning, I want to briefly look at this command that he tells us to go forward and see how it applies to us. Look again here at ancient Israel, and we see a miraculous event that occurred here. a very miraculous way of escape that God had made for them. The waters were piled up and they went into the sea, all Israel did. And in doing so, all Israel was baptized into Moses. As Moses is a type of Christ, they passed through the sea. And we see that they were baptized. We see that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You don't need to turn there, but that's the reference. This is the way, brethren, that it had to happen. It could happen no other way. This is the way that it had to happen for them to completely and to wholly leave Egypt. In order to be truly free from slavery in Pharaoh, they had to pass through the sea. They had to be buried and they had to be raised on the other side of the sea. And it gives us this type of what we need to do to leave sin and to leave slavery, to show us how Christ saves us from sin. Yes, we put out sin. As Mr. Dobson said, it's to show us how Christ saves us from sin and from bondage and from death. They had to be cleansed from their captors, and the sea had to cover up their enemies. And this is very remarkable when you think about it, because this gives us, or this example, I should say, gives us a very important spiritual lesson. And that is that our only way of escape through sin is in Jesus Christ. That is, our only way of escape is through the death in Jesus Christ. You see, when we lose our life, we save it. And once we have repented of our sins and we're on the edge of leaving sin, what does God say? He says, go forward. Go forward. You know, if one isn't baptized yet, what does God say? You're on the edge. Go forward. Repent and be baptized for the remission of sins. Go forward. Now, for those of us who are already baptized, the lesson still exists for us that we must continue forward, always being cleansed on a daily basis by God's word. And don't hang around the edge of sin. Don't hang around the edge of the wilderness. Go forward. Progress to the kingdom. Make that trek to the kingdom. Live a life that's worthy of the repentance that God granted us. And don't become weary in well-doing and have a readiness to revenge. Once we have committed obedience, have a readiness to revenge disobedience. Implicit within this, brethren, is that just as the Israelites were buried by the sea, they were raised in newness of life on the other side, just as we are raised in newness of life from the watery grave of baptism. And then they began a trek toward the promised land, just as we are now trekking toward our promised land of the kingdom of God. Though Christ's death offers a way out of sin for us, it is his life, however, that promises a continuance and the salvation to receive the gift of the promised land and eternal life. With this admonition to go forward, it is only because of Christ's resurrection that we are afforded the opportunity to do something beyond the grave. Otherwise, we would simply go back. When the vessel's been cleaned, don't leave it empty. Fill it with something. Fill it with newness of life. Else it just becomes filled with darkness again. It's because of his resurrection during these days. It's because of what he does in us now that we are able to go forward and we don't go backward. Romans chapter 6, I want you to turn there. And we see that Paul writes about this in Romans chapter 6. And let's start in verse 1 and we'll read through verse 7. Romans chapter 6 and verse 1. We'll start here with Paul writing. Well then, I'm reading from a Living Translation. Well then, should we go on sinning so that God can show us more and more kindness and forgiveness? Of course not. Since we have died to sin, how can we continue to live in it? Or have you forgotten that when we became Christians and were baptized to become one with Christ Jesus, we died with him? For we died and were buried with Christ by baptism, just as the children of Israel were with Moses. And just as Christ was raised from the dead by the glorious power of the Father, we also may live new lives because of his resurrection. Since we have been united with him in his death, we will also be raised as he was. Our old sinful selves were crucified with Christ so that sin might what? Lose its power in our lives. We are no longer slaves to sin. We don't have the spirit of bondage to fear any longer. We don't have the fear. We don't have faithlessness, and we now trust God utterly and completely. And so within these days, brethren, is not only the death of Jesus Christ pictures, but also his resurrection. And as we've heard before, this was most certainly a topic at the end of the feast and on the last day of unleavened bread at those times in the time of Christ's death in 31 AD. And so the lesson for us, as we have just a couple of days left here in this festival of unleavened bread, is that we have to go forward. We have to go forward from here. We have to move forward until we reach the eternal habitation of the kingdom of God. Finally, brethren, there is a future time when this scenario that occurred over 3,400 years ago will occur again. And I'd like you to turn to Isaiah chapter 11 to finish this up today. Isaiah chapter 11, we will see that God will once again bring his people out of slavery, out of captivity, and he will deliver them with the same might and the same power that he did with our Israelite ancestors. Isaiah chapter 11 and verse 11, it reads, "And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord shall set his hand again the second time to recover the remnant of his people who are left from Assyria and Egypt, from Pathros and Cush, from Elam and Shinar, from Hamath and the islands of the sea. He will set up a banner for the nations and will assemble the outcasts of Israel and gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth." Verse 15, "And the Lord will utterly destroy," he will dry up "the tongue of the sea of Egypt. And with his mighty wind, he will shake his fist over the river Euphrates and strike it in the seven streams and make men cross over dry shod. And there will be a highway for the remnant of his people who will be left from Assyria, as it was for Israel in that day he came up from the land of Egypt." What a beautiful picture as we come up to the last day of unleavened bread very shortly. The culmination of bringing all of his people out of sin and slavery by means of passing under the water and baptism, starting with the redemptive antitype that began with ancient Israel and continuing with those of us who are progressing towards his kingdom, those who have not yet been baptized, but who are going to one day be baptized, and they will progress in the same path. But as we move towards the kingdom too, moving on from our baptism and ending with a future time where God will once again bring all of physical Israel out of captivity and slavery with another exodus through the sea. What a marvelous time this pictures. What a wonderful day that we are going to come up and celebrate. Let's remember God's admonition to the children of Israel as it is his admonition for us today, brethren. Go forward.